went to the Arkansas Delta with a specific project.
You know, I think about you, I think about you. You're always on my mind.
To teach American history through Black literature. I imagine teaching literature that had moved me.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with memoirist Michelle Kuo. Reading with Patrick, published by Random House, is about a teacher, a student, and a life-changing friendship.
The Delta is where I met Patrick, who was 15 and in the 8th grade. Mild-mannered, Patrick never bullied anybody. He never cussed anybody out. He appeared to abide by a self-imposed code. Keep to yourself. Don't mess around. Don't get involved with other people's trouble.
Memoirist Michelle Kuo. Helena, Arkansas, and Reading with Patrick on Arts and Letters.
Yeah.
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm Jay Bradley Minnick. And welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today we'll be talking with Michelle Kuo. Her memoir, Reading with Patrick, confronts the challenges and joys of teaching in the Delta.
In college, I studied the civil rights movement. As graduation approached, I wanted to do straightforward, immediate work in places that needed people. Then I met a recruiter from Teach for America, also an Asian American woman, who told me that the schools in the Mississippi and Arkansas Delta, among the poorest places in the country, faced a drastic teacher shortage.
Michelle Kuo, teacher, lawyer, writer, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You're in college and you decide that you're going to teach in an alternative school.
The former teacher at an alternative school called me and told me, hey, we are thinking that you might like to teach at this school. And then she told me what the school was like. I thought to myself that this was possibly the hardest assignment that one could get. It was a school for kids who had been kicked out of other schools.
It was called STARS.
It was called STARS. Eighth graders who were 16 years old, 10th graders who were on the cusp of being expelled, and this was their last chance. I mean, I still don't understand why they called me.
Tell us about teaching in Helena, Arkansas. It's a rural town located in the Delta.
Yes, I think I had very little idea of what to expect. One thing that really moved me was that it was this majority Black town. It had survived slavery and another half century of sharecropping. And for me, as an Asian American, I was first shocked by how conspicuous I was. I'd grown up in southwestern Michigan, and my parents were from Taiwan. My summers were spent doing math. Like most immigrants, my parents believed that education meant safety, a ladder to prosperity.
The Delta's beautiful, and you describe it beautifully in your book. What did you notice immediately about the sense of place?
Well, Helena sits right on the banks of the Mississippi. The river is quiet. There are summer songbirds that you can always hear, and you feel like they're talking with the frogs. I went on some river rides on the canoe, and I saw these wild dewberries that just were blooming on the bluffs, and you just want to reach out and pluck them. In the water below, there were catfish that formed shadows, and you could see them move as the berries dropped into the water.
Yet, there's a juxtaposition with the town, which was kind of worn for wear.
Right. It was 2004, and that was before a number of revivals occurred. And so there were a lot of abandoned buildings downtown, wooden planks that covered windows. And the library was also dilapidated. I do want to say that really wonderful and amazing things have been done in the past decade. But when I first went there in 2004, I was startled by how much this town felt left behind. And it's an untold story in our Nationalist course, we hear a lot about Rust Belt towns, but rural towns get the hardest hit by the shutting down of a factory, which is what precisely happened in Helena when Mohawk Rubber was shut down. Helena just shuttered overnight.
Your last ride down old Central Ave. I hear you coming. I hear the tailpipes crack. But I will not hide no more. I'll be standing where you think you saw me coward before.
You write,
I began to speculate that the modern Delta did not exist in the American consciousness because it disturbed the mind. It crushed part of our American mythology.
Could you tell us about what parts of the fabric of American mythos the modern Delta disturbs?
Yes, I think kids growing up today learn about the civil rights movement as the most uplifting and honorable part of American history. And it is, there's no doubt. But there's this idea that heroes rescued the Delta, that it became desegregated and everything got better. And I think that idea of progress is really poisonous. It gives people a sense that the Delta doesn't need anything more now that it's been rescued from segregation. And yet we know that the Delta is still poor, still segregated, still in need of dramatic change. And that's devastating. You know, in the 1960s, college students from all over the country poured into the Delta. They came. They didn't doubt that they should come. And today, I think the Delta doesn't even exist on people's radar. The idea is that it's been rescued and it's fine now. But there's something really heartbreaking about the idea that, in fact, it still needs attention.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to Michelle Kuo talk about her memoir, Reading with Patrick.
Considering the Teach for America job, I began to think I could pick up where the civil rights movement had left off. I believed books could change the lives of my students. I envisioned my students mesmerized, as I had been in high school, by Malcolm X's autobiography, and galvanized, as I had been in the eighth grade, by Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail. I felt, for instance, personally summoned when King wrote, "So the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists we will be."
So tell us about meeting Patrick.
Patrick's the kind of student who you could miss if you're not paying attention.
Pick a card, any card. Don't show it to me.
He's really quiet. He always sits in the back.
Abracadabra, I got nothing up my sleeve.
And he doesn't bother anybody.
And I may get it wrong or get it right. But either way, I'm standing in the light when nothing is hid.
We know that kids bother people sometimes to get attention.
I'm the magic kid.
Because they crave attention, all kids do. But Patrick wasn't like that. He always chose to keep his head low, and he just seemed lost, like he'd gotten on the school bus by accident. And I noticed him, but I didn't really talk to him.
I'm the man.
Until just a month after he arrived, he stopped coming to school altogether.
You write, had an oracle knocked on my door and told me what the future held for Patrick, I would not have believed it. You would have shut the door, and you say maybe that would have been wrong of me, but there are certain kids for whom you bring all your hope. Was he the embodiment of that hope?
He was. There were two or three others I'd also say the same for, but Patrick especially, you just wanted to work hard for him as a teacher. You just saw that his mind was open, that he was observing everything around him. Once two girls got into a fight at the school and he jumped in to break them apart, and he said to me later, "What's the point of fighting? We're already at alternative school." I think they just are giving up on life. I think that's why they're fighting.
And who we are is who we are. Why is that so hard to be? When I watch him shine his star, it's so magical to me.
And that's a really profound thing to be able to know and say when you're 15 years old, the idea that your classmates have given up on life and that's why they're fighting. Most kids would say they're being silly, they're messing around, but to be able to understand that about your peers shows a kind of respect for them and also likely a despair in your own life.
So you saw him as self-aware, brave, and honest. But he's there because he doesn't come to school.
Yeah, but I still don't know. I still don't know why he would start and stop. I don't know exactly what he was doing. I don't know what his days were made of. I do know that when I went to his house to get him to come to school, he was at home. He didn't seem to be doing anything, and that worried me.
This world can be so full of darkness and blown out flames.
It also made it easy for, I mean, it was shockingly easy to get him to come at least for 3 or 4 consecutive weeks, because I was 22 and crazy, so I would just show up and be like, "Hey, what are you doing? Come to school." And then he would promise me to come.
It seemed at that moment when you decided to go to visit him, and you guys made a promise, you made a pact. What was that?
I told him that I would be there to watch him graduate from high school, and he kind of lit up at that and responded to that. And then he started to come.
And not only did he start to come, but he became a really good student.
He did. He won this Most Improved Student award that our principal gave him.
Trading dreams for pecking orders in schoolyard games. But you shine your light for everyone to see. The only one I've known who's truly free. Yeah, you just are what you will always be. You're the magic king.
In March, I got a voice message from the admissions office at Harvard Law. I'd gotten in. Then, at a school ceremony in the spring, Patrick won the award for Most Improved Student.
The only one I've known who's truly free. Yeah, you just are what you will always be.
When his name was announced, he looked surprised. He never won anything before.
You're the magic king.
Students cheered as he walked up to the stage, his gait slow and hunched, not sure how to act. External affirmation made him sheepish. He turned to the students who were still clapping.
Will you shine your light for everyone to see?
Then suddenly, he raised both arms up in the air, a victory pose. Everybody laughed.
Pick a card, any card.
And the students, tell us about that moment, because I thought it was beautiful, where you have to tell them
you're going to law school.
Students are so generous. You know, I just, one student said, Ms. Quo, you're not going to be a good lawyer. You're too nice. And another student who said, you've got to go get your education. I mean, there's a wisdom in there. It also broke my heart how generous they were, though, because it meant to me that they were also used to people leaving.
You know, you promised Patrick you'd be there for his graduation.
Patrick is more stoic. I'm not really sure what he thought. I do know that I understood I had made promises to him that I wouldn't be keeping, and that I shouldn't have made those promises if I wouldn't keep them. But at that point, it was too late. I had decided to go.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to writer Michelle Kuo talk about her memoir, Reading with Patrick.
Leaves are screaming, unpleasant trees. It was a place that I, but now no one sees. I found the heart of man covered in disease. Oh, oh.
I come to law school with the idea of fighting for education as a civil right. I'd had my sights set on the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and worked there after my first year at law school. But I discovered that schools were no longer the battleground for civil rights lawyers.
Lines of blur, and what is this? Life is way too intricate to be black and white. It seems it's personal, or what's wrong and right. Whoa, whoa.
The next summer, I worked at a law firm and at The Door, a nonprofit for kids. Two places that could not be more different. I was shooting darts, trying to figure out where I belonged. By the beginning of my third year, I decided that if I could get one thing out of law school, it would be the acquisition of basic skills that could be useful to poor people in crisis.
This is the place, this is the age.
I applied for and got a fellowship to work at Centro Legal de la Raza, a nonprofit in Oakland, California that served undocumented immigrants.
You're working your way through law school, things are going well. You're doing internships, you're working for The Door, you get this fellowship, and then you receive an unexpected phone call with some bad news.
Yeah, so my friend, my former roommate in the Delta who has stayed, has called to tell me that Patrick got into a fight and killed someone. And I'm just totally shocked and devastated. I really think that this must be a mistake, that it can't possibly be Patrick who broke up fights. And so just 3 days later, I fly to Helena and I go to the Phillips County Jail during visiting hours.
You make your way to the Phillips County Jail. What do you see when you arrive?
Patrick looks older. I mean, it's been 2 years since I've seen him. Well, first he looks surprised to see me, and then he immediately wants to tell me what happened.
What does he tell you happened?
He tells me that he was looking for his sister. He kept repeating that his mother told him to go look for his sister. She's a couple years younger than him, and she should have been home by then. It was a school night. He goes looking for her. He comes back, and I should say his sister's in some special ed classes. And he is back on his porch when an older guy comes with his sister, accompanying her back home. The older guy is 25. He has a reputation in the neighborhood. He's extremely drunk. And Patrick keeps telling him to get off the porch, get off the porch. And the guy won't leave. So Patrick gets a knife and stabs him. And he thinks that the man survives because the man limps away, but the man falls down at the edge of the yard, and when the ambulance comes, the paramedics cannot revive him.
The lines of blood on what is this? Life is way too intricate to be black and white. It seems it's personal or what's wrong.
You don't have a lot of time with him, do you?
Not very long. I didn't even know what to say. I think I was surprised that it was true that he had killed someone. You know, I was in my third year of law school, I immediately started thinking about legal defenses.
Right.
You know, I was like, oh, well, he was on your property. He was drunk. You didn't intend to kill him. We can get this charge down. He was charged for murder, which is definitely an overcharge. Murder is for when you premeditate. It seemed to me that the more we talked about charges, the more Patrick didn't want to talk. I think in his mind, he was guilty and he didn't want to disrespect the dead, the guy who he killed, by escaping responsibility. And that to me was also really moving.
And the colors of my mind are rearranged. It's hard for me to see things this way. The clothes you wear stay the same, but your words come out a darker shade of gray. A darker shade of gray. Yeah, yeah.
You make a promise to him, though, that you'll exchange letters, that you'll stay in touch, that it won't be such a long time. After you leave, you get outside. Does the Delta look the same to you?
That street seemed smaller and more remote. When you live somewhere, especially when you start to fall in love with it, you don't think of it as being very small. There's just like possibility. Your friends fill it up. But when you've been away for a while and you come back, things in a small town always seem smaller. And it seemed to me that there was this window of possibility for Patrick that had closed. He wasn't going to get out for a while. And it seemed also to me that we had crossed a line, that it was too late for him.
The colors of my mind are misplaced. Silver over black, white, yellow, and red. It's hard to follow waves of what you say, 'cause your words come out a darker shade of gray. A darker shade of gray.
But there's also a serendipitous sense, too. You're going to be a lawyer, and he needs a lawyer badly. And you're also his teacher, and he needs a teacher badly. So you decide to write about the experiences.
I mean, writing is a lot like prayer. You can't control the stuff that comes out of your mouth. It's just on your mind. It's on your heart. And I was just writing about everything. It just all came out. I remember the names of all my students. I remembered so much about Patrick. And when I was done, it really felt like I'd been writing some kind of eulogy.
Take a piece of denim thread, stitch your wood to your soul, like Peter's shadow.
You work on the piece, and it's published in the New York Times Magazine. Would you mind just reading about when you decide to go back and see Patrick and show him the magazine piece that you had written?
I also made another little pact with myself. When you go back in October to see Patrick, I plan one more visit before my job started in Oakland. You'll show him the magazine piece face to face. On a Saturday morning in early October, almost exactly a year since I'd last seen Patrick, I drove to Helena's county jail. There was no traffic. The streets were empty. I sat down in the waiting area. Sean, the guard, said he'd give me the lawyer's room, which was better than speaking through a plexiglass shield. He walked me to a private room labeled interrogation in faded stenciled letters. The room was dark and musky. I tried to hold my breath, not wanting to inhale the vaguely toxic smell. Patrick emerged. School had been where we connected, and I wanted to know, why had he dropped out? How had it happened? I cared as much about these questions as I did about the question of what had gone wrong one night a year ago. I suppose I believed that none of this would have happened, that we would not be here in jail, had he stayed in school. Then it occurred to me. It was an unsalvageable conversation. I had been his teacher, and he had dropped out. I knew I had to leave soon, but I still hadn't let Patrick read what I'd written about him. It was only fair, I thought, that he knew the writing existed. "I wrote this about you," I said. "It's about you and my teaching at Stars. Would you like to read it?" Patrick leaned forward, tense from concentration. Suddenly I realized he was nervous. When was the last time he'd read anything out loud? A book? A magazine? And with a teacher, no less. His left hand was shaking, and he clenched his fingers into a fist as if to tame it. His right fingers held the page gingerly, as if it might tear. I had the urge to stop the exercise, but Patrick plunged forward. He started reading very fast, affecting confidence. But immediately he stumbled on the sentence, "There was something capacious inside him." We hobbled along. I saw his eyes darting downward to the last line, near the end of the bottom of the page. The ethics of writing about Patrick had occupied me so much that I hadn't even imagined we would encounter this basic problem. He was so out of practice that he could barely read. This was the real Patrick, the one who I didn't know because I was too busy remembering who he used to be.
You fall back in yourself, my mistake again. If you could only learn how to breathe.
Later that day, I would ponder the self-absorbed foolishness of my exercise. What had been the point? I should not have put him in such a position. It was cruel. He was embarrassed. At least I could have explained to him, honestly and simply, why I'd written it, the original reasons. "I wrote this because writing is how I understand things," I could have said to him. "I wrote this to get closer to knowing you and myself, too." Or I could have helped him read, exposing the meaning of the words. But it had been so long since I'd taught that I lost my teacher's instinct and let him stumble on alone.
But you don't. You don't let him stumble on alone, do you?
I just felt sure that he needed somebody, not necessarily me, but a person to shepherd him through this time in his life. I didn't know at that time that we would be reading together every day for 7 months. That was to come later. I just felt like I needed to come back. A voice inside of me said, "If you hadn't left, Patrick might not have ended up in prison. You owe him something." And the voice continued, "Stay here. Drop everything and stay a little while."
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to musicians and songwriters Detroit Johnny, Off the Cuff, George Morris, and the Gypsy Chorus, Adam Fawcett, Hayes Carl, Radio Birds, the Arkansas Delta's own Mookie Cartwright, and Scott and Rosanna for the inspiring music that frees the soul and allows the cage bird in all of us to sing. Thanks to the wonderful and wise William Wagner for recording the show. Thank you to interns Krista Hancock, Caitlin Strain, and Marty Burton. A special thank you to Mary Ellen Cubitt, who always strives to bring us the highest quality productions. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to Michelle Kuo, whose memoir does not shy away from self-examination, and like all odysseys, discovers not only what one is in search for, but most importantly, oneself. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick.
let's heed the words of Maya Angelou. A bird doesn't sing because it has an answer. It sings because it has a song.